Well, the thing is that since the beginning of the Constitutional Convention, the right wing and the great losers of that election have been doing a dirty campaign of fake news and promoting rejection of the new constitution, even before it was written or even before we could see any of the articles. So they have a lot of advantage in that in that sense. They've been doing it for a long time, and now popular social movements and civil society is mobilizing for an approval of the new constitution. And now we're seeing that with the draft in our hands, we're going to go to the streets to talk to people and communicate the actual changes. I think that those polls reflect the control that the mainstream media have on the political narrative in Chile. We see that they have been talking most of the information that is
We
on
have 10
social media
seconds.
and mainstream media is fake news. And now we're going to see what people think about the actual constitution, the enshrining of social rights, of reproductive rights, of gender parity, of a democratic process,
Well,
etc.
we have to leave it there. We thank you so much, Pablo
Thank
Obafon,
you.
member of Chile's Solidaridad movement, anti-capitalist feminist group. We will post the Spanish conversation at democracynow.org. Happy birthday to Eli Putnam and Samin Fakhandeh. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in the middle of our annual spring membership drive. Here at KBOO, radio is our business, and you can help our radio hive thrive this spring drive. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 to make a donation today. Be sure to give by May 28th to help us reach our $56,000 goal.
Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today on Sojourner Truth, we get an update on the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Several independent investigations have concluded that she was killed by Israeli military forces while she was covering an Israeli military occupation in a Palestinian refugee camp. Shireen Abu Akleh was clearly identified as a journalist. Further, outrage was expressed as Israeli forces attacked her funeral procession. We discussed this and the latest on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with Middle East expert and author Phyllis Bennis. And President Joe Biden visited Buffalo, New York on Tuesday. Where on Saturday, an 18-year-old white supremacist killed 10 black people. He injured 3 others. Among the injured were 2 white people. We will hear the voices of Buffalo residents speaking out about what they wanted to hear from President Biden, as well as part of Biden's Buffalo speech. Also, what is the relationship between climate change and pandemics? And an update on COVID-19. Our guest is Dr. Sarah Myrie, an ocean and climate scientist. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated, so on Sojourner Truth. We work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. President Joe Biden is calling the mass shooting in Buffalo, New York by a white supremacist domestic terrorism. The president visited Buffalo Tuesday and condemned white supremacy and the ideology of hate. Christopher Martinez reports.
President Joe Biden's speech came after the Saturday shooting that killed 10 and injured 5, and revelations that the shooter apparently targeted African Americans.
What happened here is simple and straightforward. Terrorism. Terrorism. Domestic terrorism. Violence inflicted in the service of hate and the vicious thirst for power that defines one group of people being inherently inferior to any other group. White supremacy is a poison. It's a poison running through our... It really is. We need to say as clearly and forcefully as we can that the ideology of white supremacy has no place in America.
He says democracy is in danger like never before, and it's time for people to speak up as a majority that rejects white supremacy. The shooting has also sparked renewed calls for stronger gun control laws. President Biden referred to that in his speech, singling out assault weapons in particular. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
House Democrats spoke out against the replacement conspiracy theory the gunman cited in a 180-page manifesto. It claims liberals are trying to replace white voters to advance a political agenda and has been promoted by right-wing pundits like Tucker Carlson and the third highest-ranking House Republican, Elise Stefanik. Here's New York Democrat Hakeem Jeffries.
House Republicans are fanning the flames of hatred and embracing a racist conspiracy theory put forth by white supremacists on so-called replacement. And we're still waiting for a single House Republican leader to denounce replacement theory, the theory that led to the massacre in Buffalo, New York. And I'm hopeful that Elise Stefanik and my colleagues on the other side of the aisle will see the error of their ways to date and change course immediately. Because if they don't, blood will continue to be shed.
But Republican leaders sidestepped the issue Tuesday when asked about replacement theory. Senate Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell repeatedly ducked the question. Finland and Sweden have formally applied for NATO membership in response to Russia's war in Ukraine. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg called it a historic moment.
Every nation has the right to choose its own path. You have both made your choice after thorough democratic processes. And I warmly welcome the requests by Finland and Sweden to join NATO. You are our closest partners, and your membership in NATO would increase our shared security.
The applications must now be weighed by 30 member countries. The process is expected to take about 2 weeks. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has expressed reservations over Finland and Sweden's support for Kurdish fighters. The two could officially become members if Erdogan's objections are overcome. NATO wants to move quickly given the threat from Russia hanging over the Nordic nation's head. It's a stark contrast over Ukraine's bid to join NATO, which officials have said would take years. A Russian soldier facing the first war crimes trial in Ukraine since the start of the war pled guilty to charges of killing a civilian today. 21-year-old Sergeant Vadim Sheshimarin faces life in prison if convicted of shooting a 68-year-old Ukrainian man in the head through an open car window in a village in the northeastern Sumy region 4 days into the invasion. Russia says nearly 1,000 Ukrainian troops defending a giant steel plant in Mariupol have surrendered. The announcement comes as a battle for the strategic port city appears all but over. The fighters face an uncertain future. Ukraine says they hope for a prisoner swap, but Russia's vowing to try at least some of them for war crimes that could include the death penalty. Al Jazeera's reporting Russia's parliament is weighing a proposal to exclude the Azov battalion fighters at the Mariupol steel plant from prisoner swaps. A member of Israel's Knesset party is calling on Prime Minister Naftali Bennett to reveal the identity of the soldier who shot and killed Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Ahmed Al-Taibi had this fire exchange with Bennett at Israel's parliament. It was translated by Al Jazeera.
I'm challenging the Prime Minister Bennett, and I'm telling him in front of everyone that he knows the identity of the officer who shot Shireen. You know from which jeep the officer shot her from. You know the rifle and telescopic lens he used to kill Shireen.
You are lying. You are a liar.
If I lied, the entire world would know. It's not me who's called the swindler by everyone. And once again, I challenge you that you know from which jeep the officer shot her from. And you know the rifle and the telescopic lens he used to kill Shireen.
Akleh, a journalist for the Al Jazeera network, was shot in the head and killed last week. Witnesses say she was hit by Israeli fire. The Catholic Church has condemned Israeli treatment of mourners in the wake of her death. Donald Trump's choice for Pennsylvania governor has won his primary, and his Senate pick is locked in an exceedingly close contest that shows the former president's continued hold in the Republican Party. Trump's late endorsement helped put the already surging far-right state Senator Doug Mastriano over the top in the GOP governor's primary. Mehmet Oz, a celebrity surgeon endorsed by Trump, is locked with former hedge fund manager David McCormick in a race too early to call for the state Senate. In North Carolina, Trump's backed Republican Madison Cawthorn lost his re-election bid over controversial statements he had previously made. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Several independent investigations have concluded that Israeli military forces were responsible for killing 51-year-old Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, according to a report from NPR. Now, Shireen worked for Al Jazeera and was killed while she was covering an Israeli military raid on a Palestinian refugee camp in the Israeli-occupied Palestine on the West Bank. She was killed on Wednesday, May 11th, just days before the May 15th anniversary of what is known as Al-Nakba. That is when Palestinians were forced from their lands in order to create the State of Israel. Israeli forces also attacked the funeral procession of Shireen, an act that was condemned by several world leaders, with the exception of U.S. President Joe Biden. The Biden administration has called for an investigation into her death. Shireen was daughter of Palestine by millions who, over decades, watched her coverage of the treatment of Palestinian people. She became a journalist for Al Jazeera at the age of 26 years old. Let us go now to a clip from Al Jazeera.
Thousands gather in London on the eve of Nakba, the day when Palestinians commemorate the trauma of 1948.
Free! Palestine!
When more than 700,000 were forcibly expelled or fled their homeland. But now, another outrage. The killing of well-known and respected Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. She was shot dead by Israeli forces while working, clearly labeled as press. And then, at her funeral, this. Many people have many words for this attack. From the White House podium, it was...
We regret the intrusion.
An intrusion. Press Secretary Jen Psaki would not go on to condemn the attack, and the president had this to say.
I don't know all the detail, but I know it has to be investigated.
Phyllis Bennis was not surprised.
Well, there's a very consistent pattern here. The U.S. has been for decades the primary political, economic, military, strategic backer of Israel, and it's, among other things, been committed to preventing any level of accountability.
Members of Congress have weighed in on Twitter, calling it deeply disturbing, unacceptable, saying the U.S. must condemn the attack on the funeral. And one congresswoman tweeted after her killing, the U.S. must demand an end to Israeli apartheid. The German foreign minister also weighed in.
Es ist mir daher.
It's incredibly important to me, and we've made it very clear that her death is explained in a transparent way. And it's even sadder that the funeral ceremony could not be held in peace and dignity. To be honest, I'm deeply shocked.
And the French foreign minister tweeted as well, saying he was shocked and appalled, condemning the death and demanding a transparent investigation. The Israeli police say they will investigate. Given the public comments from the Biden administration, it is unclear how much, if any, pressure they will put on Israel to follow through to try and explain all of this. Patty Colhane, Al Jazeera, Washington.
Right, and part of the context of this, Israel continues to press ahead with more than 4,000 new illegal settlement homes on the West Bank, land that the Palestinian leaders are hoping for a future state. There are at least 600,000 illegal Jewish settlers who live in these Israeli-only housing complexes across the West Bank, as well as East Jerusalem. And in addition, by the way, of the killing of Shireen, a second Palestinian journalist, Ali al-Samoudi, was hospitalized in stable condition after he was shot in the back by one of the three shots that was fired at Shireen. And 16 Palestinians were injured in the West Bank city of Al-Borhey when Israeli forces attacked a Nakba Day protest. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said seven Palestinians were shot by live ammunition, three others by rubber-coated steel bullets. And the Catholic Church's top official in Jerusalem has condemned Israeli police for their violent attack on last Friday's funeral of Shireen, calling it a severe violation of international norms and regulations. Here to give us an update on the entire situation, I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Phyllis Bennis. She directs the new Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, focusing on U.S., Middle East, and war policy. She also serves on the board of Jewish Voices for Peace. Her most recent books include Understanding Palestinian Israeli conflict. Phyllis, welcome back. We heard your voice in that last clip we just heard. Welcome.
Yes, good to be with you. Good to be with you, Margaret.
Phyllis, you know, for our listeners who, for some reason or the other, may be new to this situation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I made reference to Al-Nakba, which is marked on May 18th. Perhaps just briefly give us a little historic context and then update us on these recent events. Phyllis Bennis.
The legacy of the Nakba, and it's important that we see it in the context of what exists today. This is not something that happened 74 years ago and is over. But the term, the word means catastrophe in Arabic. And it's the term that Palestinians have chosen to evoke what happened throughout 1947 and into 1948, but is commemorated particularly on the day that Israeli independence was declared, the declaration of it as a Jewish state, which was based on and strategically planned to include the mass expulsion of the vast majority of the indigenous population. About 750,000 Palestinians were evicted, were forced out of their homes, were forced out of their country. The video, the primitive video of the time that shows long stretches of lines of refugees walking into Lebanon, walking into Jordan walking into what would become the West Bank in the period after the Israeli declaration and after the war of independence, as the Israelis put it, was over. So that's the context. The reason that Palestinians are so determined to make sure that the world sees it as a continuing reality has everything to do with the question of what's going on today. And you referred to some of that, Margaret, the continuation of illegal settlement activity in the still occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, the siege of Gaza. All of these are components of what was the Nakba of 1948 and continues today. This is a situation that international human rights organizations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, various UN representatives and agencies have identified as apartheid. And again, it's important, particularly for people that are coming to this issue rather recently, to be clear that this is not based on the notion that it looks just like South Africa under apartheid. It looks nothing like South Africa under apartheid. It's a very different system. Issues of citizenship, issues of labor, a whole host of things are different. What they share is that both the apartheid system of pre-1994 South Africa and of Israel and its control over the Palestinians today both violate the international covenant against the crime of apartheid. And there are a number of components to it. I would urge people to read the Human Rights Watch report and the Amnesty International report. That's important, but this is an ongoing reality of a military occupation that has gone on in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem since 1967. And the settlement and colonial occupation of what is now all of Israel since 1948. So this is an ongoing catastrophe. And given that, I think that one of the things that's so important here, the level of outrage felt by Palestinians all around the world with the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, this extraordinary journalist from Al Jazeera, who was the known face. She was on the evening news virtually every night, 5 days a week, across the Palestinian territories, across Israel in Palestinian homes, throughout the world where the Palestinian exiles still are living. She was the voice of Palestine for many. And it was an incredibly emotional reaction. Every Palestinian I know was devastated by this, despite the fact that so many journalists have been killed over the years. 86 journalists. Shireen was the 86th journalist killed in this conflict since 1967. There have been 20 just in the last 2 years. So this is not a new reality, but there was something very special about Shireen Abu Akleh and the personal connection that was made so shockingly worse by the attack on her funeral. We've just learned today that one of the pallbearers, Amro Abu Khedr, who was the one for people who saw that extraordinarily shocking 45-second video of the Israeli police attacking the funeral procession as it left St. Joseph's Hospital en route to the church for the actual funeral, attacking and beating the people in this procession, including the pallbearers themselves, who at one point lost their grip on the casket, and her casket began to fall and was caught by one of the pallbearers. And that, I think, that moment is what made this something that was now a global moment that people are pointing to. You mentioned the Al Jazeera report, mentioned the international condemnation of this attack coming from the leadership of the Catholic Church, coming from a host of world leaders, clearly not including the Biden administration, although members of Congress have identified it as outrageous, called for an independent investigation. But this is a scenario in which Israel cannot be allowed to investigate itself. There needs to be an international investigation. The U.S. needs to worry about investigating its own complicity, because we're looking at a situation where the military aid that U.S. tax money goes to the Israeli military every year, $3.8 billion to start, and then usually close to $1 billion or more added on to that every year, without any oversight, without any conditionality, without any control. And in this situation, when we are paying for what amounts to 20% of the entire military aid budget, we have to recognize that there's a very good chance that U.S. money paid for the weapons that were used at the funeral and for the weapon that was used to kill Shireen. for the bullet that killed Shireen. And that's why there needs to be an investigation here in the US of what violations of US law, aside from the international law violations. The Leahy Law says explicitly, and I would quote it here, and it's talking about military assistance. It says, no assistance shall be furnished under this act or the Arms Export Control Act to any unit of the security forces of a foreign country if the Secretary of State has credible information that such unit has committed a gross violation of human rights. There is no question that there is credible information from the journalists that were standing right with Shireen when she was killed that it was Israeli soldiers who were firing. The Israeli claims right away, of course, that, well, maybe Palestinians fired. They've pulled back from that because it's become clear, not least from an immediate investigation carried out by B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, that the Palestinian fighters who were involved earlier that day in a clash with Israeli troops were nowhere near where Shireen and the other journalists were standing. So that simply faded away. So now they're claiming, well, we don't really know. We will investigate. Not to worry, we'll do the investigation. We know from the past, even when other US citizens were involved, when Rachel Corrie was killed in 2003, a US citizen who was working in Gaza, helping to protect Palestinians from having their homes demolished by Israeli soldiers, she was killed by an Israeli soldier using a bulldozer as a weapon. And while US administration and particularly members of Congress, some of whom are still around in Washington, were very sympathetic, very empathetic, very helpful to the family, they were never willing and able to actually demand of Israel a serious investigation. So the questions that they asked of the Israeli authorities were never answered, and there was never any consequence. And that's what Israel is counting on today. We can't assume that the Biden administration is going to be any different. It's going to depend on our movements keeping up a level of pressure more than ever before to demand not just a transparent investigation, but an investigation rooted in international law and independent of Israeli control. That's the only way that we're going to have a serious beginning of finding of complicity and of the accountability that's so desperately needed.
Yes, and Phyllis, really, really good breaking that down for us there, making it very clear. Phyllis, you are on the board of Jewish Voices for Peace, and just in terms of the attitudes here in the United States, I'm wondering if you have noticed any shift that has happened, not only among the Jewish population in the U.S., but people generally, because as you know, there is a defensiveness that if you in any way critique Israeli policies against Palestinians, that means you are anti-Semitic or some such. Right. And I have heard that particularly among younger Jewish people, that there really is a shift of people being more open to making that critique. And also in terms of the boycott, divest, sanctions movement, I mean, it was a bit of a surprise, perhaps not, to see the Harvard Crimson, I don't know if it was last month or something, come out in support of the BDS movement that has been so under attack and practically criminalized by the U.S. Congress in some ways. So tell us about the view now in the United States, if there seems to be more openness to having a very clear-eyed view about what is happening to Palestinian people and the connection of being anti-racist, saying you're anti-racist on the one hand, but on the other hand, not condemning what's happening to Palestinian people. Particularly, just one other thing too, with this whole great replacement theory business, with what happened in Buffalo, where the claim is that Jewish people in the United States are orchestrating, in part, this great replacement theory. Phyllis Bennis.
Well, you raise a bunch of important questions here, Margaret, and the first part is so very, very important, that there is a massive shift underway in public consciousness and a significant shift in the media coverage of the questions of Palestinian rights, of Israeli oppression of Palestinians, of the issue of Israeli apartheid. What we're seeing is very visible in the polls. And polls, of course, you have to be careful with polls. Polls are a snapshot. It's a moment. But when there's a trend where poll after poll after poll is consistent, then you can look at polls and say, yeah, we're seeing a real shift here. So in the question of opinion in the Jewish community, the shift over the last, say, 5 to 10 years has been extraordinary, particularly, as you say, among young Jews who are growing up committed to progressive politics, as Jews traditionally have been in this country and elsewhere, except on the question of Palestine. But you did see in the civil rights movement, the vast majority of white people who were involved in the civil rights movement, who went south with the Freedom Riders, et cetera, were Jews. In the Communist Party, there was a huge disproportionate number of Jews among the white people in the Communist Party. And that's been a long-standing reality in this country and others. What we're seeing now is that that gap between the position on everything else and the position on Palestinian rights and recognizing Israel as being responsible for the oppression of Palestinians, that gap is narrowing. In recent polls, 25% of American Jews said they believe that Israel is an apartheid state. That's an amazing recognition. We're seeing huge shifts in the Democratic Party, again, particularly among young Democrats and among Democrats of color, who are saying that the Democratic Party needs to do more to criticize Israel, saying that there should be a reconsideration of the U.S. military aid to Israel. And people have different views on it. Some say it should be ended altogether. Some are saying it should be conditioned on human rights, making sure there's no human rights violations. There's different opinions, but the shift is massive. Where we're not yet seeing the important shift is on the question of policy. And here we're seeing a shift in the discourse in Congress, and that goes both to the champions of Palestinian rights who have made incredibly important statements, powerful statements, condemning Israeli actions, the most recently, of course, the killing of Shireen, the attack on the funeral, et cetera, what's going on right now at Masafer Yatta, where hundreds of Palestinians are facing eviction in what will be the largest dispossession of Palestinians as a group since 1999. So there's positions in Congress that are moving, but beyond that, we're seeing shifts among mainstream members of Congress. For example, there were 12 Jewish members of the House of Representatives who pressured President Biden during last year's May of 2021, the attacks that Israel was waging against Gaza and against Jerusalem at the same time. We saw 12 Jewish members of Congress pressing Biden to push for a ceasefire, which he was at that time refusing to do. We saw 25 senators doing the same thing. Crucially, we saw 500 former staffers of the Biden campaign, the Biden presidential campaign, the people who got him elected, who signed an open letter that identified issues of ethnic cleansing by Israel and demanded a reconsideration of the U.S. relationship. So all of these shifts are underway. One of the challenges that we face as movements, the movement for support of Palestinian rights in this country, is to make sure that members of Congress and members of the administration are aware of that shift so they can no longer claim and no longer, frankly, believe, as I think many of them believe, that it is still somehow political suicide to criticize Israel. It simply isn't. It doesn't mean, and this goes to the second part of what you raised about the false accusation, the weaponization of the accusation of anti-Semitism, which is absolutely on the rise. It's being used particularly against students, student activists, organizations like Students for Justice in Palestine and others. It's being used against young Palestinians. It's being used on college campuses against faculty as well as students to claim that any mobilization of support for Palestinian rights is somehow anti-Semitic, when we know that the real threat of anti-Semitism, which is on the rise in this country, is coming from the violent white supremacist right wing. It's not coming from critics of Israeli occupation and Israeli apartheid. So we saw, as you just mentioned, in Buffalo, the link of this, I don't even know what to call him, but this person who carried out this slaughter of African Americans in Buffalo, in his manifesto that is reportedly written by him, he linked it to other earlier actions. For example, the killing of Jews in their synagogue at prayer in Pittsburgh several years ago, when the claim was by the shooter that he was attacking Jews because a historic Jewish refugee rights organization that does incredibly important work right now on the southern border, dealing with a whole lot of refugees from Central America and elsewhere, the organization HIAS, that they were somehow responsible for bringing immigrants to the U.S. who were replacing good white Americans. The same thing happened in Charlottesville at the Unite the Right movement that led to the killing of one of the anti-racist, anti-fascist protesters. In that march of these right-wing organizations, these violent white supremacist organizations, the chant was, "Jews will not replace us," which is based on this theory that you mentioned, the notion that Jews are leading a campaign to replace legacy, this is the term they like to use, quote, legacy Americans, meaning white people, leaving out, of course, the real legacy Americans, who are the Native Americans, but leaving out that, taking the position that somehow there is an effort underway led by Jews to end the rights of white people as a majority and replace them with people of color. And this linkage between anti-Semitism and racism, anti-Blackness and anti-Semitism, have a connection. They are both being targeted. Jews and people of color are all being targeted, not in the same way, it's not to the same degree, but there is this link between the struggle against anti-Semitism and the struggle against racism and against white supremacy. There are links, and that's where the movements need to be coming together for this struggle. That's where we need to be working for Palestinian rights in the context of an anti-racist understanding in this country across the whole set of issues involving challenging the weaponization of anti-Semitism, challenging these white supremacist violent organizations and individuals.
Right. Well, on that note, I know you have to dash. Phyllis Bettis, you break it down so very well and to help us and our listeners understand what is going on and also the context of it. And I imagine, Phyllis, just very quickly, people can follow your work. You publish quite a bit. And in terms of Jewish Voice for Peace, people can do a search online if they're interested in that organization and support.
JewishVoiceForPeace.org.
Thank you so much, Phyllis Bennis. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a brief station break. And then coming up, we want to share with you some voices of residents of Buffalo, New York, saying what they expected to hear from the Biden administration, and then followed by part of what President Biden had to say in his visit to Buffalo, New York. Of course, this following the massacre of 10 Black people, 3 other injured, including 2 white people. Stay with us. We'll be right back. That is a Palestinian folklore song by Ya Zarif Etul. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. You're a member of Facebook. You can like and friend us there. Our handle on Instagram and Twitter at SoTrueRadio. We're also nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. And in the U.S., we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the great state of Maryland, in Maryland. And internationally, we would like to give a shout out to SoundCloud listeners in the occupied areas of Palestine. Now we're going to share some voices from you. All of you know about the shooting, the horrific shooting that happened in Buffalo, New York this past Saturday that caused the lives of 10 Black people. 3 people were injured, including 2 white people. 18-year-old white supremacist did the killings, and he was very much inspired by previous white supremacist killings in the United States, but also as far away as New Zealand in that horrific attack that happened in 2 separate mosques against Muslims. Also, Phyllis Bettis mentioned earlier the shooting of Jewish worshipers in their synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Latino people being being shot in Texas in 2019. Now, apparently the video of that shooting is still being seen, even though we're told that it was taken down 2 minutes after it started. He live streamed the whole thing. But you have supporters of his, perhaps some looky-loos, but disturbingly, some supporters who saved the link and are posting it. So millions of people are watching it. And of course, this is what the shooter had hoped for and the reason he live streamed it. But it just really underscores the challenge that we are facing, eradicating this, what can only describe as a movement, a white supremacist movement, talking about this great replacement theory. But President Joe Biden visited Buffalo, New York on Tuesday. And first, we're going to hear the voices of some residents of Buffalo saying what they would like to hear from the president. And then you will actually hear the voice of President Joe Biden in Buffalo. Let's go to those clips right now.
Jill and I have come to stand with you. And to the families, we've come to grieve with you. It's not the same, but we know a little bit what it's like to lose a piece of your soul. When you lose a son, a daughter, a husband, a wife, a mother, a father. What happened here is simple and straightforward. Terrorism. Terrorism. Domestic terrorism. Violence inflicted in the service of hate and the vicious thirst for power that defines one group of people being inherently inferior to any other group. A hate that through the media and politics, the internet, has radicalized angry, alienated, lost, and isolated individuals into falsely believing that they will be replaced. That's the word, replaced. I call on all Americans to reject the lie. And I condemn those who spread the lie for power, political gain, and for profit. White supremacy is a poison. It's a poison running through our, it really is. Running through our body politic. And it's been allowed to fester and grow right in front of our eyes. No more. I mean, no more. We need to say as clearly and forcefully as we can that the ideology of white supremacy has no place in America. We can do this if we resolve to do it. If we take on the haters and those who don't even care, it's just about profit and politics.
Once again, we see an horrific act of violence and violation to a Black community. And we have to ask ourselves, what is happening in the life of an 18-year-old that he drove hundreds of miles into a very specific community and did such a horrific, violent, violating act, and he has completely, completely shattered our community. What I would like the Biden administration to do is I would like to see them declare that our city is in a state of emergency. I think we also need to be coordinating a plan of what will things look like a month from now? What will things look like 6 months from now? And where are we gonna address the fact that social determinants of health have already been a problem in our community, hence why we only have one grocery store that's accessible to our entire community. So how are we gonna address the lack of those things in our community, understanding that when those things are already lacking and now tragedy hits, you leave people with huge gaps.
It was our elders that fought so hard to get a grocery store in this community, in a community that's been suffering for decades from lack of access to fresh and healthy food options. Now I think since COVID that we're starting to pay more attention to lack of access to healthy food, but it's been something that this community has always faced. If we're not talking about the deep systemic racism that's plagued the city of Buffalo for decades, we're completely missing the point. And I'm pleading with the President of the United States to pay attention to what's happening in the east side of Buffalo.
You know, people are saying this is not Buffalo because this person didn't come from Buffalo. But to me, this is Buffalo. This is America. This is an American problem. White supremacy and systemic racism are American problems that we all have some level of complicity in because we allow it to go on. So, like, if we're not hearing those kind of messages coming from the top, then to me, it's not really being taken seriously. And I think President Biden needs to speak to those problems.
This has such a greater impact than just the trauma and the loss of lives. This was people's livelihood. There are people who worked at this Tops, and they will not be able to go back there. There are people who rely on this grocery store, and they won't be able to go back there. And the state of this community shouldn't have been like this in the first place. So we need to think about not just that this was a sadness, not just that this was just a tragedy, but what are we going to do after that to make sure that the story of this community in the future is less devastating.
Oh boy, there you go. We actually heard first President Biden and then residents of Buffalo. We're going to be continuing to cover this story. Of course, we'll be having more discussion on it, in particular on our weekly roundtable this coming Friday. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We would now like to turn our attention to the COVID-19 pandemic and also the health impacts of climate change and the pandemic, and is COVID-19 an example? But just to give a few quick updates on COVID-19, you know that deaths in the United States have now passed the 1 million mark. Imagine that. How much more can we stomach? And the White House is holding its first coronavirus briefing today, the first in 6 weeks, this according to the New York Times. And of course, the Biden administration still struggling to persuade the U.S. Congress to authorize the billions of dollars in new emergency aid for the pandemic response. And on Monday, the New York Times is reporting that the administration did let a deadline for lifting the public health emergency pass. That deadline was due July 15th, but the Biden administration had promised to give cities 6 months' notice before that. And the White House on Tuesday also said that people are now eligible for a third order of free at-home coronavirus tests shipped through the Postal Service. So if you haven't gotten yours, there is a way that you can do it. There's a website, a federal website called covidtest.gov, where you can get that information. Over 70 million households in the U.S. have already gotten these, ordered these free tests, and about 350 million tests have already been delivered. But meanwhile, L.A. County, there's some trouble brewing in L.A. County, where the number of cases have shot up, so have the number of hospitalizations. There's not yet a mask requirement imposed in LA County. Also, San Francisco, they're seeing similar things, results happening. And of course, the same is true in New York City, where the mayor has issued an alert around it, again, not requiring masking. But what we're going to focus right now, and I would like to welcome our guest to discuss this, is that there's scientific analysis that is now linking environmental change and new diseases. I'd like to welcome our guest, Dr. Sarah Myrie, a climate and environmental scientist with expertise in environmental justice and land use decision making. She is a program director for the Glesser Progress Foundation, which is based in Seattle, Washington. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so Sarah, you have referred to this analysis now published in Nature magazine. And earlier on in the pandemic, we also had some discussion on the show about the relationship between climate change and pandemics and perhaps new diseases emerging. Tell us a little bit about that, and also about this term that I have seen used that describe this kind of interchange between the wildlife and human interaction? Sarah?
I'm happy to, and thank you for the question. They are functionally connected because the way that diseases emerge, these are zoonotic diseases, they emerge from places where ecosystems and animals are operating within the balance of the natural system. And as humans encroach through destructive land use patterns, these are the expansion of freeways, the expansion into areas that have never had people developing homes and infrastructure in, people become more closely interactive with communities of animals that might be host to novel infectious diseases. So it's not just expansion, but it's also driven by poverty. And it's driven by really an extractive and abusive system that people are trying to live within. So people at the edges of development that are experiencing really precarious situations are then moving into wildlife habitats, searching for food, searching for resources, and they're being forced into exposure with zoonotic diseases. So it's tightly coupled problem. These zoonotic diseases, they have been skyrocketing in rates because of land use changes and the destruction of biodiversity. And this system of land use, extraction, and oppression are all fundamentally linked to climate change, because climate change is a symptom of the way that we treat each other and the way that we treat the world.
Right. And the combination too of climate change and pollution, you know, which helps to cause climate change, really impacting the most impoverished people around the world, not only in the United States and around the world. And he also make a good case that when we look at these things, we can't just simply be nationalistic about it, which I know is so much the tendency in the United States, but you really have to look at this across borders around the world, and also looking at the populations that are most impacted. And we do see an uptake, quiet though it is kept, of people who are climate change refugees, some of that fueling some of the people coming from south of the border, fleeing drought, etc., but also indigenous peoples having to relocate as a result. And then you have inner city residents like me. I feel as though I'm a victim of it in a way, having lived for decades very close to the 10 freeway and have developed a respiratory syndrome where I, you know, they're just things that I used to be able to do that I can't, and places, a place that I used to live that I can no longer, is simply because of the impact on my health. So just talk a bit about the globalization of these issues. And the word you use, zoonotic spillover, I had never really heard of that, but you kind of explained a bit of what that is. So Sarah, your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that you're having respiratory distress, and the way that fossil fuel pollution is just atomized in our individual, in our family lives, in our own physical well-being is really, it's really painful. And, you know, it's just staggering, the deaths, the global deaths that are caused from fossil fuel pollution. In a research study of from 2018, published by scientists at Harvard, looking at global deaths, they found that 1 in 5 deaths worldwide is caused by fossil fuel air pollution. This is a staggering number.
Wow.
Of people. Yeah, and what it reflects is the this interconnectivity, really, as a planet, that we share so much vulnerability and risk, because diseases like zoonotic diseases, and that's basically a fancy word for saying diseases that are biological, that are spread amongst animals, and we as people are animals. We are vulnerable to these diseases. You know, diseases have no boundaries and no borders, and neither does fossil fuel pollution, and neither does the consequences of that pollution. So the increase in heat extremes, the increase in flooding and catastrophic storms, sea level rise, all of these things wash across national borders. And nationalistic thinking, the idea that you can harden and prevent, you know, these biological and physical impacts from flooding and flowing across your borders is really, it's not scientifically based. And it's undergirded by narratives of hate and xenophobia, racism, misogyny, and every other system of, you know, thinking about dehumanizing people who are different than you. So we have, you know, we have some really big problems. And I think we're having this conversation particularly because it's important to look directly at these problems, because we don't have to default to a world where we normalize the externality of mass death. We don't have to live in a world where we just say, you know, business as usual. The cost for business as usual is 1 million people dying in the United States. That's the horror of that should take our breath away. And it's not the default option. We can actually choose to use an ethic of care to address these systems of oppression, to really care about each other across national borders, across differences. So I, even in the midst of all of this, it's just, you know, painful and destructive, I have hope, and I have a renewed commitment to the possibility of truly progressive change.
Right. And finally, we just have, you know, just about 2 minutes or so, but you also are quoted where you talked about the politicized leadership of the pandemic. And I mean, we saw, you know, we see that. And for, you know, for somebody who is vulnerable, some people like myself, for example, when you go into an area or you take a flight or whatever, and people are unmasked and they don't care about it, or they may even attack you for wearing a mask. I've also heard disability organizations speak out about this, and you talked about caring, yeah, the care for others and the ethic of care. So it is not only a protection for oneself, but a protection for others, starting with the most vulnerable among us. And we have seen the high rates of death among Latino people, among Indigenous people, among Black people, among impoverished people generally. So just your final thoughts on how all of this became, you know, the politicized leadership that you spoke about. We've got about a minute, Sarah.
Well, ultimately, the politicized leadership is because leadership norms have been hijacked by interests that are captured essentially by fossil fuel companies, oil and gas companies. The same avenues and routes of mis and disinformation that have really poisoned the narrative and public communication about climate change are the same avenues and routes of mis and disinformation that ideas about COVID have been spread. And we are swimming in a rhetorical and communicative environment that is poisoned by information that is not true and is targeted as a weapon. And so in this moment, in this very challenging moment where people are trying to understand the truth, ultimately we can speak to these fundamental values of caring and of stewardship. And political leaders, yes, they can use science. Yes, they can use evidence. Yes, they can employ these tools for the best possible decision-making. But if they are not using a tool of the ethic of care, if they do not extend worth and dignity to the people that they purportedly serve, those leaders are not fit for the job. And right, we should stand up to these narratives that continue to dehumanize our neighbors and our community.
Right. Well, on that note, Dr. Sarah Myrie, thank you so very much for joining us.
Ultimately, I would direct people to the environmental and social justice organizations that are in their neighborhood, in their community.
Okay. Right. On that note, we really have to dash. Well, Dr. Sarah Myrie, thank you so very much for joining us. And I would like to thank, we're out of time, so I'd like to thank all of today's guests. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our engineer, Gary Baca, our assistant producer, Alicia Vargas. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. And you all, please remember to stay well and safe. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me? I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that is probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun. Living in the city where I'm working like a walrus, but man, I don't need your money, man, I'm gonna be an artist. And I'm feeling like I wanna do whatever I feel inside. I put it all on paper and I'll hope that people buy it. And my only minor worry is how to pay the rent, but that won't even matter when I lose my apartment. And I'll really have no worries, I'll be just like a cassette that you've taped up the tabs of to put something new on it. And when I hit record, God only knows what I will be. And if there is no God, then it's a better mystery. Fighting for survival, and I guess I must be winning. And my story is so long, I can't remember the beginning. Am I an optimist or am I a pessimist? If I see that half full, half empty cup is half full of nothingness.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.